If you were faced with him in all his glory, what would you ask if you had just one question?
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones, no relation, by the way. On today's episode, we welcome John Raymond, author of the new novel God and Sex from Simon & Schuster. John is the author of five works of fiction, including the Oregon Book Award-winning story collection Livability, and the novels The Half-Life, Rain Dragon, Free Bird, and Denial, which was nominated for an Oregon Book Award. As a screenwriter, he's collaborated on numerous films with the director Kelly Reichardt, including Old Joy, Wendy and Lucy, Meek's Cutoff, Night Moves, First Cow, and Showing Up. He also received an Emmy Award nomination for his screenwriting on the HBO miniseries Mildred Pierce, directed by Todd Haynes and starring Kate Winslet. He was the editor of Plasm Magazine Associate and contributing editor at Tin House Magazine, and a member of the board of directors at Oregon's Literary Arts. His writing has appeared in Zoetrope, Playboy, Tin House, The Village Voice, Art Forum, Book Forum, among many others. He lives here in Portland. John will be launching the new book this evening in conversation with Justin Taylor at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland at 7 p.m. Please join us for our conversation with John Raymond, which is already in progress. Well, John, I'm so happy to be talking with you. I love the new book. When we were scheduling the interview, I mentioned the two films you co-wrote that are among my favorites, Old Joy and Showing Up. Both films take place in and around Portland. The new book, God and Sex, takes place in and around Ashland in Southern Oregon. So very Oregon.
Yeah, yeah.
And you grew up here in Lake Oswego?
I did, yeah. My family moved up here when I was 8 years old. That was back in 1979, so quite a while ago. Yeah, then I went to high school here, then went away for a while and came back. But at this point, yeah, I've been here way longer than almost anyone else that I meet.
Well, you're a native. That has a lot of cachet.
I'm pretty close to a native. Close to a native, yeah.
And you've called yourself a self-professed regionalist. What appeals to you about the Pacific Northwest, Oregon in particular, as a setting for much of your work?
What appeals to me, I guess, is just that it's the card I got dealt. You know, I mean, this is the place where I grew up and where I, you know, understand the geography, where I knew people from very early age. It's the place where I, you know, went into people's houses when I was a kid and saw their families functioning or not functioning. It's the place where I did my adolescent hijinks. You know, there's just a certain way of knowing a place that that I think you have to kind of live through in a certain sense. And so it's not that I necessarily chose this out of, like, it wasn't really a choice. It was more like just
this is my home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, I think that, you know, I mean, that said, one doesn't have to write about where they're from. One can write about, you know, pirates and leprechauns if they want to. But for me, there's just, yeah, something like politically interesting, I think, about just paying attention to what's in your backyard. And, you know, that is, you know, there are ecological politics to that, and there are, you know, personal politics and state politics. Like, there's just a kind of localism that I kind of subscribe to when it comes to paying attention to the world.
And you just have to look at your work to see you have not exhausted the possibilities of Northwest. You've said, and I quote, "I think of my relationship to the landscape as being pretty suburban for the most part, but it still functions as a relationship to nature, even though it's not totally deep in nature." And I see that in your work with characters themselves who are pretty suburban, interacting in and with nature. And as we see in God and Sex, nature can both be soothing and it can also be threatening, perhaps most dramatically, actually, in God and Sex.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, it is the most catastrophic sort of representation of nature that I've done so far. I mean, the book before this, Denial, is sort of a science fiction-y, soft science fiction book.
Yeah, that, it takes place, I think, in 2052.
Takes place in 2052 and is sort of post global Green New Deal. And so there has been some major environmental reckoning in that one. And certainly fires are existing in the near margins of that book. But this one, not to give too much away, but like there is a forest fire that is pretty protracted and threatening in it. And, you know, I mean, sadly, that's just like sort of a form of realism at this point. You know?
Exactly.
I mean,
we go through it here with wildfires.
Totally. And it's an annual or biannual trauma that we all are kind of dealing with, and that collectively we've chosen not to do anything about, in a sense, that, you know, rather than address some of the root causes of this stuff, I guess we're just going to armor ourselves and our cities to the point where we just endure this over and over again.
Yeah, it's very sad. And, yeah. And under the current administration, I don't think there's a whole lot of hope.
No,
not on a federal level.
No.
Now, the new novel takes place in Oregon, but in Ashland, not Portland. And Ashland's a small town in southern Oregon, predominantly white. It's a college town, home of Southern Oregon University, which is the model for your fictional Klamath University in God and Sex. Also the famous Oregon Shakespeare Festival. So certainly a very different demographic than its neighboring town, Medford, which is also mentioned in the book, about just a 20 minutes drive north. So I was wondering, you've called Ashland a total navel of New Ageism. So it seemed like you said it there. My guess is it's kind of perfect to highlight the distinction between that New Age spirituality, a kind of a non-secular blend of philosophies and systems, you know, a very eclectic, and a more traditional, maybe orthodox religious belief and faith.
Yeah, I mean, that whole region, that kind of what has been termed the Klamath Knot, near the Klamath Mountains there, including Ashland and Mount Shasta and, you know, just little pockets of land all around there. I mean, it has been a real magnet for New Age seekers for generations at this point. And it has, I think, developed like a pretty distinct spiritual profile, you know, and it's exactly what you're talking about, this kind of syncretic blend of Eastern philosophies and yoga and UFOology and, you know,
right,
like,
especially
all this kind of stuff.
You mentioned them, I think, the Lemurians.
The Lemurians, yeah. And, you know, it's easy to satirize that kind of stuff and it's easy to, you know, dismiss it. But, you know, I actually grew up, you know, kind of in that tradition in some ways. My dad was a practicing Zen Buddhist and with very distinct Sufist kinds of leanings. And the, you know, the library he had was filled with Alan Watts and...
I used to listen to his radio show.
Oh, that's so great.
A very soothing voice, but such a wise, intelligent guy.
Yeah, wise, intelligent guy. And, you know, Ram Dass and, you know, for my dad, it was Gurdjieff was a big one. And, you know, these are all kind of, you know, definite cornerstones of a kind of alternative spirituality on the West Coast, or what I've heard talked about as a California consciousness in some way. It's not one of the major monotheisms, but it certainly draws on those things. And for me, this book was always going to be about like theological questions. And there's a, I mean, it's modeled very much on a book by Graham Greene called The End of the Affair, which you and readers may know. Graham Greene was sort of strange Catholic writer. He had very much his own form of Catholicism.
And he was conflicted about it. I actually looked up the movie because you had mentioned that as an influence.
Yeah.
It also features a love triangle, like God and Sex, with a woman named Sarah
in
the middle, who's the woman in the middle of this love triangle.
Exactly.
Between Arthur and Phil.
Yeah, and that one takes place in London during the Blitz, and it also has a kind of miracle at the center of it that has major theological consequences. And I saw a way in which that kind of sort of nearly heretical Catholicism that Graham Greene toyed around with could actually be kind of recast into this California alternative spirituality, New Ageism, that, you know, that also is a very personal relationship with whatever the divine is that you're talking about. And some of the same questions that animate that book, The End of the Affair, just about one's obedience to God, one's understanding of God. Yeah, those, like, we have a different kind of vocabulary and a different sort of way of feeling about it, but there are comparable ways of doing that. So for me, that was kind of the experiment of the whole thing, was recasting some of that Graham Greene book in a Southern Oregon sort of mold.
Yeah, so let's get to the title, God and Sex. Yeah. Again, the theology and then the sacred and the profane, I guess, in yeah. a way. There was a recent New York Times review just a few days ago, a beautiful review, and they love the book. The review called God and Sex the two biggest short words in the English language, which is hard to disagree with.
Yeah.
They're rife with meaning and connotations, some personal to people.
Yes.
It's referenced in the book, perhaps explained by Arthur's mom. Arthur is the main character who's writing this book called The Tree Book.
Yeah.
He's kind of into that West Coast spirituality.
Yeah, but like a slightly more sophisticated
version. Yeah, a little
version.
More sophisticated, yeah, but not, definitely, not quite the crystals and the beads the tarot reading and all that, or the I Ching. And she says, God and sex, those were the ways people commune with the divine. And she adds, or the way the mind broke. So both have the ability to connect us to others and to something higher, but also have their pitfalls, which is extremely evident in God and sex.
Well, and if you're going to say they connect you to the divine, it means you sort of believe in the divine, you know? So, I mean, you know, there's a lot of talk. I mean, the book gets kind of Kierkegaardian in ways and, you know, you talk about like Abraham and Abraham's kind of mandate to kill his son and like the... You know, that sort of testament of faith at the base of
the most extreme
version of a faith relationship. And like, you know, if you believe in God, then that is, you know, the ultimate sort of test and act of belief.
To kill something
to kill your dearest sort of thing. If you don't believe in God, that is totally psychotic behavior. I mean, that is like the definition of an insane person. And so,
you're hearing voices,
and you know, and that's where you get into the sort of Kierkegaardian element of it. You know, that this contract between the supplicant and the divinity, like, has to be insane on a certain level for it to qualify.
Because otherwise it's not based in reality. It's not based in
I mean, it demands a leap of faith in a certain sense, you know?
Exactly.
Otherwise, it's just a transactional relationship, you know? Like, I'll do this and you do that. It sort of has to be pushed to this extreme. And yeah, for it to really register as a proper theological faith.
And of course, we won't get into the way it's pushed to the extreme in the book, because that's one of the pleasures I think the reader has waiting for them. But in the book, Arthur describes the goal of his writing, and he says it was closer to the pursuit of divine communication, a way of feeling the presence of fate in my life. And I was wondering, are you like a Graham Greene, also conflicted about your religious beliefs and maybe find that path through your own writing?
I mean, I'm not super conflicted. It's just I don't really have a great relationship with a particular faith tradition or anything.
But unlike Greene and Catholicism.
Yeah, Graham Greene definitely went out of his way to cultivate a very agonizing relationship with some sort of Catholic deity. But no, I mean, I was raised, more in a kind of Buddhist tradition, which is more low-key and is more open to... unknowing.
And actually pretty more accepting, I think.
At
least
think
the literature is.
I think
they
certainly
don't say Jesus is the one or Buddha is the one or Muhammad is the one.
Certainly in its like California iteration that I was sort of reared with, it's quite tolerant and laissez-faire. But yeah, the question of like the sort of writing practice and the sense of the numinous or the spiritual embedded in that. I mean, that is, I think, a reality in writing. And I think that there's a seeking of signs, and there is an openness, you know, when things are going well, like there are serendipities and kinds of not direct communications, but kind of strange coincidences that will occur.
And writers are always asking, where is this coming from when things are going right?
Yeah, totally. And you know, and often it's, you know, it's like, oh, I didn't know I needed to read this book right now. Or, oh, I didn't know that I was, that conversation was exactly the thing I needed to solve that problem. And that's like a really daily part of the writing process. And so, I mean, for me, in kind of building this book and trying to create a, you know, a plausible theological environment for everything, it kind of had to proceed in steps that were more relatable before it became an extremist, you know? So,
right.
You know, there are, you know, there are many ways in which just basic laws of karma, I think, play out in people's lives all the time. And many small things that people can't really quite explain, or that you attribute to something outside of your, certainly outside of your will. And yeah, part of the ongoing writing conversation in the book is sort of a way to acclimate people to the idea that, okay, there are forces that are happening out there that we all can agree on are there, but unseen. And then now let's like push it to the further
right.
level, you know?
So Arthur's really the perfect main character. Yeah. He's a writer of these semi-spiritual books about nature,
yeah.
trees and light. Also, I was going to say that a lot of writers have like religious adherence. They have rituals and relics.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They might keep, a rock on their desk or something,
yeah.
or a memento, and they might go through a little ritual before they sit down, maybe prayer.
yeah.
Hope it comes out today.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Well, or this, the writing itself, I think, can be construed as a kind of prayer, you know, I mean, or certainly a kind of a meditation, you know, I mean, you are, yeah, fixing your mind on a particular subject and you are silently contemplating it. You know, there is a definite monk-like quality to that life.
Who are also writers, monks.
Yeah, certainly.
Copying.
Yeah, right.
Not necessarily coming up with fiction.
Yeah.
Now, again, we'll stay away from the plot turn that the book takes, leave that as a surprise. But I wonder if we could talk about your own thoughts in exploring the powers of the divine. So on that extreme end, a god or someone like him or her. There was a Washington Post review, also another glowing. I mean, every review I've read so far, the book just loves it.
Yeah, so far so good, yeah.
Yeah, so Ron Charles, the reviewer there, wrote, "I would be less surprised to hear a burning bush talk than to find a miracle interrupting a literary novel." So the plot turn is quite a leap, and again, without saying what it is.
Yeah.
John, did you have any reservations before jumping, taking that leap?
Not really. I mean, it's... I mean, it's true. I guess it's an unfashionable topic in a way.
Yes.
But I mean, some of these questions and sort of these addresses, I guess, to something outside of the character's social world. I mean, that has happened in the things that I've written over the years, you know, and that is, you know, as with everyone, like you direct your thoughts sometimes into inanimate places, or I mean, yeah, to talk about God is always like a little uncomfortable for me, but like I can talk about the universe or the world, or you know, there are sort of other ways of sort of casting it where you're just like, oh, it's just the world, you know?
Right.
I think that kind of conversation is something that I assume everyone kind of has running in the back of their heads in some kind of way, some sort of observation of just the totality of everything. And
or a wonder. Yeah.
You know, or this, a wonder. I mean, ultimately a wonder. How did, what, how did this happen?
God's,
what is going on? Yeah.
God's kind of a,
totally,
almost
yeah.
a simple answer.
Yeah.
To
and how
question.
Did this begin and how's it going to end? I mean, it's just like, these are basic sort of questions of consciousness.
Why am I here?
Why am I here? And like, yeah. And like what, yeah. How did that tree or rock get made? You know, like it's trippy. So why not think about it? I think it's a pretty, I mean, in some ways, it's a very safe territory. It's like territory that is common to almost all of humanity. So I don't know Well, I don't know if it has been like a fallow field for contemporary literature. Like, I don't necessarily maybe read enough to know. I guess Ron Charles would know better than I.
Yeah, he must read a lot.
he must read a lot. Yeah.
He has to read a lot.
So I'll take his word for it, but this is strange. I didn't know it was that strange.
I didn't really feel it was that strange either until I read the review.
Yeah.
But I guess it depends what he's been reading.
Exactly, yeah.
Maybe not Graham Greene.
Yeah.
Now, the friendship between the two main male characters in the book, Arthur and Phil, two-thirds of this triangle we talked about,
yeah,
mirrors male friendships you have in your other work. And I'm thinking of Cookie Figowitz and King Lou and First Cow, also in Half-Life here at your first novel. And Mark and Kurt, one of my favorites, in Old Joy.
Yeah.
So that dynamic is of some interest to you, certainly as a story element, that male friendship, not necessarily buddy-buddy in every case.
Yeah. I mean, that was something I thought was underappreciated in books when I first started writing books, with The Half-Life in particular. The Half-Life is a book about two friendships. One of them is between this Cookie Figowitz and his friend, and then
one in the present, more current time.
Yeah, and then there's another friendship that runs alongside that, which is between two teenage girls. And at that time, yeah, I was, you know, I thought just not even contemporarily, but in general, like, you know, that literature was often more interested in either romantic relationships or familial relationships. And, you know, in my life, the friend relationships have been incredibly formative and rich and dramatic. And I wanted to foreground that kind of relationship. And also, again, there is a kind of a political element too, where a friendship is a relationship between equals. You know, it's a horizontal kind of relationship. And I found that just in a sense of democracy, I kind of like the idea of exploring relationships between fellow citizens that are trying to understand something, rather than people who are inherently already in a hierarchy. And so that sort of theory of the subject matter has kind of followed me along. But, you know, part of it is the theory, but then also part of it is just the intuition that, like, oh, these seem to be the kinds of stories that I am drawn to, I guess. And so, yeah, I mean, it's sort of weird to be as old as I am now and to have numerous examples scattered through the past of, like, these kind of friendship stories. And I mean, Denial also ended up being a kind of friendship story. Yeah, it's interesting. And I will say this one is a little different and something a little bit vexing for me about it, because it is a male friendship in a triangle. And I think it's because of that. Yeah, there are there are ways in which that, how am I going to say this? There are erasures of the, like the woman in some ways in this, as in many like historical books, becomes a kind of conduit for the male friendship. And that's something I've always like kind of explicitly tried to avoid, but it did kind of happen in this particular structure, and something that I struggled with in it, but ultimately kind of acquiesced to.
You did.
I don't know if this makes sense, really, what I'm saying.
Oh, yeah, but I would say that you do give the woman, Sarah, quite a life of her own.
Oh, she has a life of her
very
own.
Very independent character.
She's not
just a tool of the plot.
Right. Although she's not just a tool of the plot, but she also is a tool of the plot. But they're all tools of the plot.
Yeah, characters. Yeah. Characters are kind of like that.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to talk about two takes your characters have on environmental activism. In God and Sex, we're introduced to a couple, Candy and Merle, and we see them regenerating a meadow south of the novel's main setting in Ashland. We mentioned it, Cascade Range near Mount Shasta.
Yeah.
So part of that same Cascade Knot, you're talking about that. They're repairing damage and neglect and bringing the natural state of the land back to life. Now, in your film Night Moves, which I viewed again recently, rewatched, the three main characters, another triangle, are more radical environmentalists.
Yeah.
They plan to blow up a hydroelectric dam on a river east of Ashland. So similar crusades in geographically close settings, yeah, but very different tactics.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, with night moves, yeah, the sort of question that I feel like we were asking was, why am I not blowing up the industrial infrastructure, given all that we know?
It's the only thing left to me in a way.
Yeah, well, and it's just like if things are truly as dire as we all believe them to be, like, you know, at what point does this direct action just become an imperative? So that was sort of an exploration of that idea in a certain genre form. These two characters, yeah, are more, they're less violent people. They're people who are operating out of a more, I think, nurturing and not necessarily a more hopeful ideology, but one that is definitely more purely non-destructive. I mean, they're just trying to create the world that they wish would exist rather than destroy the world that they don't want to have exist. And so, those are different orientations to treat the same problem.
Certainly, yeah, then this regeneration, which is actually not destructive, but constructive.
No, that's what I'm saying. Those, yeah, the regeneration people, they're like, let's build the world that we wish existed.
Right.
And leave the destruction to someone else.
I know exactly the three people to call. Now, you said, and I'm quoting, both Night Moves and Denial are definitely crime and punishment kind of narratives. And particularly with Night, yeah, Moves, I was thinking of the political extremism, yes, and the kind of virtue that's addictive to certain people.
Yeah.
And the sort of black and white morality that people can fall into. These are all your words.
Yes.
And that black and white morality by the characters in Night Moves leads to unintended consequences and a crime and punishment-like situation,
yes,
for them. And you mentioned in the acknowledgments in God and Sex, a book called The Believers,
yeah,
by Lisa Wells,
yes,
as an influence. I picked it up. There was a quote from the book, "Paranoia, antipathy, and defensive aggression are all predictable responses to a zero-sum world divided into us and them." And the characters in Night Moves have similar responses. One spills.
Yeah.
You know, talks, spills the, yeah, beans, one, yeah, hides, and the other grows increasingly,
yeah,
increasingly defensive and extremely desperate.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, I think that is the cost of perpetrating crimes and of doing these kinds of, you know, black ops or whatever. Yeah, there's a psychic toll that takes. There's a paranoia and a suspicion that you have to live in. And in that story, it causes everyone to unravel and really extreme kind of ways. I mean, it was funny. First I'll say Lisa's book is fantastic. And actually the Merlin Candy characters that you're talking about who are doing the regreening project in the Cascades are very much drawn from her book because she profiles various people.
Oh, that's right.
Stories of people who are doing constructive things. Yeah. And that have like found ways of engaging this calamity in ways that are, yeah, creative and nurturing as opposed to just paranoid and desperate.
It brings up, I don't know if you've read it, I haven't the whole, yeah, way. William Volman wrote a 7-volume essay on violence called Rising Up and Rising, yeah, Down. I love his work, but I couldn't get through the entire,
yeah,
7
I haven't
volumes.
Read it.
It's,
yeah,
awesome. He comes up with what he calls a moral calculus of violence. In effect, when is it justified,
right,
to use violence, when isn't it?
Yeah.
And it stems from his student days protesting the Seabrook nuclear power plant in New Hampshire, mm-hmm, kind of like this hydroelectric dam,
yeah, right,
in Night Moves. Do you think it's ever justified for an environmentalist or group to use violence as the three characters do in Night Moves? Or do you feel it's, as in the movie, always counterproductive?
Right. I mean, it depends on how you define violence, I think, in many ways.
Yeah, this was violence against property, not against,
which,
people.
I don't really construe as violence, yeah. Uh-huh. I think, yeah, to me, violence against property is not really violence. It's it's vandalism or destruction, but it's not properly violence. I did a really interesting interview when Night Moves came out with an anarchist for an anarchist publication, who was really upset at the depiction of anarchists in Night Moves because, according to this person, you know, anarchists are really inherently nonviolent people and that they take very seriously the sort of precepts of it. And I'm sure that is largely true.
That was true of these characters in Night Moves. I mean, the unintended consequence. I guess I could talk
well, exactly.
And it's been out for a while. Somebody dies dam blows up.
Totally, yeah.
And, they're just filled with guilt and
they're
shame.
Filled with guilt and yeah, there are, I mean, it is very much a crime and punishment scenario where the kind of consequences of their crime are far worse than the crime itself in a certain sense. And the nature of the sort of crimes that are perpetrated, you know, or the nature of the violence that's perpetrated are they come from different angles. There are multiple acts of violence in that film. You know, there is the blowing up of the dam. I'll just go ahead and talk about it. That results in an unintended death. And then as the people unspool and the stakes become more desperate,
there's another
murder that's a right. more proper murder and that has no political sort of valence at all. It's just really a murder of self-preservation. And this is where this anarchist was really upset, where, like an anarchist wouldn't murder someone. And my response to that is that you don't know if you're going to murder someone or not in certain circumstances, you know, like there are, yes. like I can buy that, like the vast majority of direct action people are, you know, very committed to like nonviolence and would never actively pursue anything like that. But I also feel like I understand just from understanding history that, yeah, there are circumstances where people behave in many kinds of horrible ways. And
it was very well laid out in Night yeah. Moves. I mean, his motives, obviously he was not a killer from the very start.
Right.
But,
right. But he was a weak person in some ways. And so, yeah, I think, but yeah, I mean, and that film was also built as a way of thinking about political extremism in general. And it's funny that, you know, came in like 2011 or something. And in a way it was sort of a response. Well, actually not, it was very explicitly a response to the rise of the Tea Party movement at that time, you know, where people were flying airplanes into IRS buildings and stuff. And, you know, there was a sense that there was a kind of rhetoric that was beginning to seep into American life that was becoming much more comfortable with, like, not property crime, but actual violence against other people.
There was a recent example of a guy that killed the CEO of United Healthcare.
Totally. No, and I was going to say, like, at that point, things have metastasized, like, into, like, an insane carnival of violence. I mean, it's like we are living in some insane times right now. But I mean, the Luigi thing is a crazy, crazy event.
People defending yeah. that.
And so anyway, but the Night Moves for me, like I can't understand sort of the right wing fantasy of violence at all, but I could understand radical environmental fantasy of violence. Like that actually is something I can inhabit in my own mind in a way. So even though that film is about like a black bloc of direct action environmentalists, the kind of subtext for me, and you know, maybe this is what the anarchist guy I was talking to was objecting to, was the sort of other side of that horseshoe, you know, and that this is about political extremism just in a costume that I can relate to, but that is really sort of about other people as well.
Oh yes. Yeah. I did not think you made any kind of leap of credibility
yeah.
in the movie. It was all, you know, step by step yeah. laid out.
Right.
Again, like I would say, like Dostoevsky in Crime and Punishment.
Yeah, I mean, that was definitely in a very pretentious way. That was that was an influence. Yeah,
you got to borrow yeah. from the best.
I mean, you got to. You know?
I think Bob yeah. Dylan said that.
yeah.
Now, in an interview, John, you did for your previous novel, Denial, that was kind of the speculative fiction one. You said,
yeah.
pretty much my whole life, I've been reading and watching stories about the destruction of the planet. Boy, we're kind of overloaded with those now. At some point to me, the fantasy has started to seem like a death wish. Humanity obsessively fantasizing its own annihilation, almost willing the worst possible fate to unfold. I decided I wanted to write a book that got off those rails and foretold a future wherein human and plant life continue to survive, in some ways, even to thrive. And then you go on to say that's a much harder act
yeah.
of imagination, I think, but one that's really necessary now. It's beyond time we start putting our minds to what a plausible, livable future might look like given our situation. Now, that we mentioned that takes place in 2052, and you know, quite a bit of speculation there.
Yeah,
God and sex is more current day. One of the three main characters, though, Phil, the friend in the triangle, he's a forest ecologist. He's talking to his friend Arthur, and he says, "Storytelling is a kind of conjuring, isn't it, Arthur? It's how we bring the future into being." And I know you must feel that way as a storyteller. And my last interview was with Lydia Yuknovich for a memoir. She says the same thing about conjuring.
Yeah.
Stories, changing the story. Maybe your story was like doom and gloom.
Yeah.
You can write yourself a new story, create a new story for yourself, conjure yourself a new story.
Yeah. I believe that to a degree, you know. You know, and in a way, this is, again, it's part of the sort of new ageism that we live in, this idea that, like, you are the creator of your own reality, that you are that we are somehow the sculptors of our own lives, you know.
Which works to a certain point.
Which, yeah, I think works to a certain point, but there are cards that people get dealt that are not really negotiable in that way. And that's where you start bumping into, certain deistic questions, you know. And I think that works for individuals and it works for societies. There are currents of fate and there are forks in the road and there are untenable choices that are presented. And like, I don't really think any amount of like good thinking is really going to help that, you know. And I think it's popular in literature now to, you know, to think of writing as a form of activism in a certain sense, or a form of, you know, creation of new worlds. And like, I want to believe that that's true, but I also like fiction that describes the world as it is, you know, and I find actually that to be really admirable, and if not like inspiring, at least gives me solace, you know, that like, oh, there is an accurate representation, and look, people before have had the same sort of feeling, and you know, these problems or this kind of moral fix that like might seem utterly blinding is actually part of the pattern of life for a long time. So yeah, one wants to conjure a nice, happy new world, but also one wants to describe the world like it actually is.
But one could also conjure a kind of a doom and gloom world.
Well, totally.
You mentioned like zombies and...
I mean, that stuff I have zero interest in. Yeah, you know, right. I mean, it's like, yeah, just like...
I think there's way too many zombies on TV and in
totally.
Books.
Totally. I could care less. I mean, honestly, if I even see a gun, I'm usually like, whatever, I don't care anymore, you know? But yeah, zombies, post-apocalypse, it's just like super boring to me.
Now, there was a very good review of God and Sex. In fact, there's only very good reviews of the book.
So far.
I'd be hard-pressed to say anybody didn't like it, but not to say that there won't be. That was in the latest Portland Monthly magazine. And the reviewer writes, "The six movies John's made with director Kelly Reichardt spanning Old Joy 2006 to Showing Up 2022 expose holes and open secrets in popular and comfortably held worldviews. The movies are gorgeously upsetting. Sexy? Not so much. And while his solo work tends to include a few more fireworks, Raymond pushes further in his latest book, Finding the Bounds of Realism in Faith and Lust." And I'm not sure you found the bounds of realism in Lust, but it's depicted so well and often in concise but graphic detail in God and Sex. Kind of a departure for you in a way, huh?
Yeah. When I first turned the book in, my editor was like, if your book is going to be called God and Sex, you got to put more sex in it.
Really? Did you? Or?
Well, yeah. I mean, it was there, but it was a little more soft focus, I think, before. And so... I mean, it was kind of a great assignment to get, where it's like, all right, well, if I have to do this, I guess I'll give it a try. And so, yeah, I did kind of try and dial it up a little bit. But you know, it's funny. It's a different. It's an interesting like thing to do, particularly as a having it depicting straight male sex which is what this book is doing primarily. I mean, it's through the main character. I think that is it's a complicated and, like, at this moment, not super popular kind of form of writing. You know, I don't think the world is really asking for straight male sex books, you know, at least not the world I live in.
They want a little more transgressive, yeah. I think.
Transgressive or coming from different places, which I think is great. And, like, but, you know, I'm not the one to write those books, but this is the kind of sex I'm assigned to write. But it is...
With your editor's approval.
With my editor's approval, yeah. But, you know, writing straight male sex is, you know, we are now multiple generations beyond the kind of sexual revolution where, you know, at least in America, you know, our current kind of sex vocabulary and our just sort of way of thinking about sex really, like, exploded in a certain sense. And, you know, those writers like John Updike or Philip Roth.
Writer that came to mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, exactly. I mean, there's a certain crew of, like, 60s and 70s guys that, you know, at the time were doing things that they construed as transgressive and radical and explicit.
And maybe it was in the 50s.
And you know, anti-Victorian, you know, I mean, they're trying to sort of break these codes of silence and repression, you know? And I mean, really, if you want to, like, dig into that, they're trying to break those codes of silence and repression because of the events of the 20th century. And that, you know, there was, I think, an intellectual belief that those codes of silence and repression were part of what created, you know, fascism, you know, and that in its extreme, that's what occurs. You know, that I think that has proven to be not really accurate, but, you know, you can understand what they were, where they were coming from. That said, like, the sex that they wrote has not aged very well, you know, and I think in retrospect, you know, it's pretty clear to see the sexual revolution was in many ways kind of a revolution against women. You know, I think that was, you know, a movement of, like, incredible male prerogative. And
you certainly see that in Updike and Roth.
Oh, for sure. Totally. And a million. And then, you know, so there have been subsequent generations trying to kind of avoid those pitfalls. And you know, and one of the ways of avoiding is just to avoid talking about sex at all, you know, and just to sort of create really neutered fictive environments. But
you can't do that in a book called God and Sex.
Well, no, you can't do it in a book like this, nor do I think, you know, you should do it in general. Like, I mean, obviously sex is a big part of life, and it's it'd be sad to never kind of air it out in a certain way.
Well, I guess it's hard, though, to hit that right note between something too chaste and Penthouse Letters, for example.
Totally. I mean, this is the most I've talked about the sex scenes in there, but I hope I never have to again, but it's like,
it's just beginning,
but it is like, you know, it is, I mean, it's so easy to write things that are ridiculous in that way.
Oh, yeah, there's an award, I think, given every year for the worst sex scene.
Yeah.
Now, I'd like to talk about writing screenplays and writing fiction. You started purely as a fiction writer with your first novel, The Half-Life, 2004. That book, in your own words, didn't make a big splash, like a lot of debut novels, but caught the attention of Kelly Reichardt, which led to your first screenplay in collaboration with Kelly, Old Joy, and subsequent ones. What did Kelly see in the book and you as a partner in the first and of several more and continuing?
Yeah, I think she saw proximity. Like, I was there. I was, like, nearby. we had met through our mutual friend Todd Haynes. And, you know, Kelly was looking for something to adapt that was small enough for, like, a kind of micro budget that she had been able to pull together. And
$30,000, I think.
I believe that's what I have been told.
Incredible.
Yeah. And so, yeah, she had read The Half-Life and had enjoyed that. And, you know, that was much too vast for her to worry about. But she asked if I had any other material, and I did have this story, Old Joy. And
from Livability.
It would eventually be in Livability. Uh-huh. Yeah. And, Yeah, I've said this before, but like I can't imagine another director that would have looked at that story and been like, oh, here's a feature film. I think that I see something.
That might be one of the reasons
there.
I love it so
you know?
Much.
Yeah.
You totally. Just don't see it.
You don't.
Not much happens at all. There's no great big dramatic scenes, but it's so human.
It's a exquisitely made film.
Yeah.
It's I mean, I think, you know, in the realm of like naturalist short story writing, like it's not a very bizarre story at all. I mean, it's a small story based on sort of emotional pivots that are quiet and, you know, come to minor little epiphanies. But in the world of feature filmmaking, they're incredibly rare. And to marshal even the smallest movie apparatus to make a film that quiet is just almost unheard of. So, I mean, and Kelly is that very rare kind of filmmaker that likes to work at a human scale and likes to do things that are kind of rigged to the way people actually see and breathe and think. And,
oh, man, and, you just have to watch Old Joy and Showing Up and you'll know exactly what John's talking about here.
I mean, it's amazing how rare she is. Yeah.
And her films are often called slow cinema.
Mm-hmm.
Slower pace than most commercial movies and somewhat contemplative. But I would put in the same category some of my favorites. Tarkovsky.
Yeah.
One of my favorite movies of all time is Andrei Rublev.
Oh, my God. Yeah.
And even my favorite movie of all time, Kubrick's 2001.
Yeah.
Which could only be made as a movie. It's a movie. It could never be a book. And they tried.
Yeah.
But it was a failure, actually, with Arthur C. Clarke.
Yeah.
And in God and Sex, you have Arthur talk about his idea of the slow universe, John, which he describes, quote, as a pudding-like undertow to the bright, gaudy cosmos of streaking comets and flaming meteors, a place of belated consequences and time-delayed realizations, or you use the words, little epiphanies.
Yeah.
It's almost as if Arthur is speaking metaphorically of your films and Kelly's. Do you get that?
Yeah, or just of our lives. I don't know. I mean, it's funny. I hadn't thought about that as describing the actual movies. But I mean, definitely, yeah, I mean, that idea of there being some sort of slow, more glacial thing going on in one's life and in one's mind.
It's not all traumatic. One traumatic.
It's not all drama, you know.
Another.
Exactly. Yeah. And that. But those are actually seismic, you know, and that there are interesting things going on, sort of quietly under the surface. That are not going to come out in like dumb arguments between people or ginned up dramas, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the book, in addition to God and Sex, it also confronts the problem of real death, not just a metaphorical one. Arthur says it was shocking how life never reconciled itself to death in the entirety of existence. Life had never figured it out. This was one of the reasons people, I think, turned to religion or Buddhism.
Yeah.
Many of us feel that same way, especially when thinking of the deaths of people we love and they're gone and our own mortality, our own inevitable.
Shocking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Phil says, maybe it's in the nature of some things to be hidden. I love that line. And it's kind of a comfort in a way.
It is. Yeah. And I mean, for me, the sort of ultimate religious roots of this, like for me, date back to really my college time when I was studying art history and became interested in certain like medieval discourses of divinity and representation. And that kind of reading led back to a writer named Pseudo Dionysius the Areopagite, who was actually more of a 4th or 5th century Greek theologian, who is credited with sort of being one of the early explainers of negative theology, or what people call the apophatic tradition.
What's negative theology?
That sort of stems from the premise that there is something ultimately that the true nature of the divine can never be understood and can never be represented properly. And so the only real response to that is through a sort of negative attribution, like it's through, it's a, rather than a positive attribution through a negative attribution. So it's always like, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this, it's not this.
But don't ask us what it actually
but
is.
But don't ask us what it actually is.
I always think that in, like in science, you know, they have the Big Bang Theory and they say, this is how the universe began. I keep thinking, well, there's got to have been something
before that. The big,
there? And so, scientists will tell you there's no way we'll ever know. So why even think about it?
Well, and that, I mean, and I think inherent in the Big Bang Theory, are, you know, extremely rich theological conundra. You know, I mean, it is, I mean, it's when you're pondering the infinite, you're in that world. And so, But that sense that there is something explicitly hidden, you know, is really embedded in that apophatic tradition.
Maybe
that,
unknowable too.
Unknowable. And
so
in
it's
fact,
not like you can go out on a scavenger
hunt. You can't really find it.
Find,
I mean, you have to look, but you're never going to find it kind of thing. And I mean, Pseudo-Dionysius talked about it as the super unknowable. And so there is some super unknowable, like, thing that may or may not exist that is, beyond representation. And, you know,
what was Aquinas's quote? Do you remember that?
I don't know, but Aquinas is definitely in all that stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. It was something, his definition of God was anything beyond which we can't conceive.
Oh,
like
in
that.
The book. Yeah. Right. It's a funny quotation from Aquinas in the book. Yeah. That beyond which we cannot conceive. It's a weird phrasing, but it is basically like everything you don't understand is the divine in a certain sense, you know.
Right.
And I have found that to be an interesting model. And the book is really built around that shell game, you know, where the kind of whatever is divine in any given moment of this book is the thing that's not there. You know, it is a kind of roving absence that hopefully is dramatically absent.
No, my last questions are on projects that you're in the midst of, or I think might be. One, I know you are, and there's a blurb on the cover of God and Sex from Hernan Diaz, who wrote the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Trust.
Yes.
And you're actually adapting that, I think, now into a screenplay. But he says, in Trust, God is the most uninteresting answer to the most interesting questions. And I wonder if that quote made it to your screenplay, John, and maybe in what context?
Oh, I don't know if it made it into the screenplay yet. I mean, that is an ongoing project.
That stood out for me.
Yeah, right. It's great. I mean, it's a fantastic, it's a beautiful book. And it has been like one of the huge creative thrills of life to work with both he and Todd and kind of refiguring it for
Todd
screen.
Haynes.
Yeah,
and
Todd
you worked
Haynes,
with
yeah.
him previously.
And I've worked,
Mildred Pierce.
Yeah. And it's funny. And I think Aaron is a much more strict atheist than I am in a certain sense. You know, he's a more rational and intelligent person than myself. So it is, I mean, it was kind of him to blurb the book and he's a lovely person. And I think that there's a squishiness to my own theological musings in this that like might be alien to him in a certain way.
And one more project, which I don't know if you're currently working on, but I read an interview you did with Oregon Arts Watch in 2022. This was for the book Denial, that speculative fiction book.
Yeah.
And you're quoted as, I will say, though, I'm at a point right now where I'm not entirely sure what the next thing is going to be. It's one of the first time that's happened in a long while. There's a nonfiction thing that I'm kind of toying with, but that would involve a lot of interviews with people. So it'd be something I would work on for a while. Is that something you're working on?
No, that one did kind of fall away. That was something that really had to do with like 2020 here in Portland and the events of 2020. I mean, in a way, Denial and God and Sex
the BLM protests and
and some of the violence that occurred, and you know, maybe there is still something to do there. But I mean, both of these books have been very much post 2020 books for me. You know, just sort of dealing with, in some ways, the aftermath of particularly those events here in Portland, and particularly
and COVID.
COVID.
It's like two different worlds.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, between COVID, the rise of fascism.
Yeah, Trump won.
In 2020, those ongoing BLM protests that, you know, were also, you know, patriot prayer kind of fascist sort of street brawls. And then the mega fires, you know, I mean, it was like, that was truly an insane year. Yeah. And so trying to sort of grapple with all that stuff, yeah, is an ongoing process. And yeah, there's a more direct nonfiction treatment of some of that stuff that maybe still could happen someday, but it's not something I'm doing right now.
Well, John, thanks so much for talking with us today. God and sex may be the two biggest short words in the English language, but I think you've done them both justice in the new book.
Thank you so much.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KBOO Community Radio. If you missed any part of the show, would just like to hear it all again. You can stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. Before we head out the door, a big thank you to our guest today, John Raymond, author of the new novel God and Sex from Simon & Schuster. John will be launching the new book this evening at 7 p.m. in conversation with Justin Taylor at Powell's City of Books in downtown Portland. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, August 28th. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
God only knows what I'd be without.